Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. We are, in fact, doing a special today where we are departing South Africa's shores for foreign climes. I'm joined today by Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. It's good. It's good for the sort of fake Brit to be joined by a real Brit and just make me seem actually very provincial in my mannerisms.
Yes, and adding some gravitas and actual knowledge to our conversation today is Ed Polsu, who is actually British, and he is joining us from London. Ed, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Delighted to reach out from an exotic foreign clime and speak to you from London. Very much for having me.
That far away, wet, soggy island. We have a freezing cold day today in Johannesburg, which would be presumably a sort of mild summer's day in the UK, but it's neither here nor there. Right, let's talk about this British election that's just happened. Ed, let me start with you. I'm going to ask that most horrible sort of cliched of questions about elections that they always ask journalists and then expect them to play sort of an almost mystical role of, what was the mood out there on election day? What was the mood in the UK in the lead up to the election that just took place? What were kind of people saying? What was the feeling you got?
I think that's a good question. Easy ones first. I think certainly what's been borne out by the results is that I actually can't give you an answer for the entire country, because we now sit with, I think, what is largely regarded as one of the most fractious, tomorrow, for the first time, Parliament will sit, and it will be one of the most fractious parliaments ever, because of the sheer number of different parties. I mean, there was some crazy statistic about, for the first time ever, more than four parties having some reaching over a threshold, I can't remember which one. So, you know, I can tell you what I saw as the mood, but I mean, it's not going to be that helpful, because as we've seen with the results, it's been completely divergent across. It's wonderfully iridescent. So from what I saw, the mood was very much anti-Tory. I'll say that much. And I think that was perhaps the dominant feeling across anyone. And then I think for a number of people, it was how on earth am I going to vote now? It was sort of, they were sort of present some people, the sort of not natural Labourites, not natural Farageists, not natural Tories or you know, Greens or Lib Dems. They were wondering what they were going to do in order to express this lack of satisfaction with the Conservatives. And then I think when I was actually away on election day, I got my postal vote in. But when I got back the day after, I think there was a genuine feeling of palpable relief, a dominant feeling of thank God that's over. And I don't just mean the election. And I think a definite feeling certainly amongst young people, that Britain had, you know, become a kinder country. Certainly something that I read quite a lot of on, you know, Instagram and Twitter and what have you. I think there was relief. I think there was relief and a genuine feeling that the right result had come about, and that's just from a top line, you know, and we can, I'm sure we'll get into it a bit more about how that result is not all it seems on the tin. Yeah, I think palpable relief is how I put it after the event.
So for those who weren't paying attention to the election results that came out, the Labour Party won a big majority, 411 seats of the 650, about 63% of all the seats in Parliament. The Conservative Party, formerly, who had a majority, dropped to 121 seats, so down a big number of seats there. The Liberal Democrats shot up from, I think it was like 8 or 9 or something like that, number of seats, all the way to 72, which is pretty good for them. The Scottish National Party, which had 50-something, got whacked down to 9. And entering Parliament for the first time is Nigel Farage of the Reform Party, whose party managed to win 5 seats which of anything that Nigel Farage has been involved in, this is the most parliamentary seats they have ever won. In terms of vote percentages, though, there's a little bit of a interesting thing here, and we'll get to this later in the discussion. But despite the fact that Labour won this huge number of seats, they only got about 33.7% of the vote, the Conservatives dropping from about 43% of the vote to 23.7%. The Liberal Democrats on about 12%, and Reform UK, despite only getting 5 seats, won about 14% of the vote. The Green Party also got 6% of the vote, but only 4 seats. So, I mean, that's all quirks of the British electoral system. But, Herman, I just want you to cast your mind and thoughts back to 2019 in the UK. There's just been the very, very divisive, bitter, nasty fight over Brexit. The Brexit referendum came in with a vote for Leave, and then there was an awful lot of shuffling about and stabbing each other in the back and fighting and squabbling and all that kind of thing that politicians like to do over the details of how that would take place. And in fact, there was even a little bit of an effort by some in the political sphere to reverse the results of the referendum, say that, you know, no one voted for no deal or no one voted for a bad deal. There was an election in 2017, which produced this sort of slightly, I would guess, inconclusive result. And then 2019 comes along. Boris Johnson leads the Conservatives into a majority victory. He wins 43% of the vote. He smashes Jeremy Corbyn in a whole bunch of seats in places that Labour was strong for a long time. He looks in many ways like he's kind of king of the world. He manages to then charge forward towards Brexit with a strong party behind him. What happened to his party? Down 20 points, down more than 200 seats. How did the British Conservative Party get to this place?
Well, I think the first thing is that we must understand that this is a party that had been in power for 14 years. And by British standards, that's quite long. I mean, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had Labour in power for 13 years, and Margaret Thatcher and John Major had the Tories in power for about 18 years, just short of it. So 14 years in power is pretty much at your saturation point, typically for governments in the UK. And there comes a point when these governments just stick, you know, past their sell-by date and cling to power. And what happened with Boris Johnson is I remember when he won his, 86 or something seat majority, there was immediately talk of, another decade in power for the Tories. Johnson apparently told advisors that he wanted to outlast Thatcher's record of 11 and a half years. And there was this sort of hubris of thinking that a big majority won is one that would deteriorate, as traditionally did in the 20th century, over multiple election cycles, is that you get sort of this big majority and then it is whittled down over time until you lose it 3 or so cycles later. Because that's what usually happened. It was very, very rare for a seagull just to fly past a camera or whatever that was. Cats, seagulls, awful creatures make horrible noises. But the idea of sort of this majority being established and then whittled down, that was sort of very much the 20th century mindset of UK politics. And within 5 years, the Tories went from gaining, 43% of the vote to losing 20 percentage points and falling to their lowest total number of seats, since I think 1832, sort of since the great reforms that happened that allowed, that broadened the franchise. And part of that, what happened is, obviously we have to address the elephant in the room, is the fact that in 14 years in power, where previously both the Labour and the Tories had, gone through 2, maybe 3 prime ministers over such a period. The Tories had gone through David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and Rishi Sunak. Five prime ministers in 14 years is not something that speaks of intense stability or actually even proper party management. So the first thing that happened is that this sort of musical chairs of political leaders, of prime ministers, just, I think, started grating, started to be quite annoying with this British sense of, you know, get along with the job that you were given and stop making a fuss of things. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the nature of Boris Johnson's fall was very damaging to the Tory party because it was, you know, quite sleazy. And when you look at his term in office, he was just a bad administrator and he was a bad party manager. So he might have had a big majority, but that majority became quite rebellious. Because the party management just wasn't good. And then that was exacerbated by Liz Truss, that traditionally the Tories have been very proud of being the, you know, the party of sound money and good business and solid economic sense. And then you have this dangerous idea of being willing to borrow massive amounts of money, discovering Jeremy Corbyn's magic money tree, borrowing to cut taxes, and promoting that as somehow Thatcherite, whilst it was obviously not. I mean, just go look at the 1983, 1981 budgets of the Thatcher era, where they, you know, put up taxes to make sure that the money supply was brought under control. And then the markets rebelled quite viciously. And Liz Truss couldn't even, you know, manage a piss up in a brewery when she appointed the worst whipping team that the Conservatives had ever had, where the whipping team themselves couldn't even make sure what party or what, you know, what lobby they were supposed to go through. So then came Mr. Sunak, poor Mr. Sunak, you know, managerialist, probably quite nice, competent, respected for his role during the COVID pandemic with his furlough scheme. But the problem with the furlough scheme for which he was responsible was that it was bloody expensive. And it was going to have to be paid for. And the Tories then used every trick in the book that they possibly can to push up taxes, the overall tax take, to its highest level in about, I think, 70 years or so. And that really left people bitter. Because you have Boris Johnson campaigning, they will lower taxes, you know, and then they do nothing of the sort. You have this idea that the Tories are the economically sensible party, and then they give us Liz Truss. Then the whole thing just came down where people stopped listening to what the Conservatives had to say, because the Conservatives were clearly not listening what the people were saying. And I say this as someone who would be, you know, a very boring fuddy-duddy of a Conservative were I to be British. But poor Mr. Sunak faced the situation where after 14 years of really nothing to show for it except the chaos of Brexit, with the early post-credit crunch wins of the Cameron government quite far behind us, he had to go to the electorate with essentially an empty prospectus of what they had accomplished, a record that they couldn't really boast of, and against the most boring prime ministerial candidate at the time when all the Brits wanted was a boring prime ministerial candidate in Keir Starmer, in the sense that people were sick and tired of just not knowing where the Tories are going and what they're going to, you know, find out, you know, find to turn on each other. And perhaps last final point is the Conservatives, David Cameron got the Brexit referendum, he made it happen, lost. That then destroyed Theresa May's prime ministership because she couldn't find a deal that that would satisfy her party or the Commons, lost her majority. Boris then came in and won a massive majority on the get Brexit done idea, without really explaining the details of it. And people voted for the get Brexit done idea because they were by that stage quite sick and tired of Brexit. But beyond that, the Conservatives have failed to deliver on any of the Johnsonian promises of what Brexit would mean. It's very, very difficult to look over the last 5 years and see anything resembling a true Brexit success, which the Tories were absolutely responsible for and had the chance to deliver on and simply didn't. So when the voters decided to just, you know, say enough's enough, they gave Keir Starmer, what did Fraser Nelson call it? A Potemkin majority, a Potemkin landslide, because it's numerically massively impressive. I mean, to win 421 seats out of 650 is huge. But they got it on, 35% of the vote. So people weren't in love with the Labour Party like 97 when Blair stormed home with a 179 majority. So this was more, as I think Ed said, you know, a thing of let's just get rid of them at last and give this other bloke a chance rather than, oh, you know, Keir Starmer, he's the guy we want to put up Hope and Change posters of.
So, Ed, firstly, I mean, any thoughts on anything Herman said? But also, I don't know whether you have a particularly strong view on this, but I'm going to ask. Electoral reform in the UK, I mean, this is an odd election when you have these sort of vote percentages quite far out from seat from what people get in the Commons. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not a rigid Democrat thinking that every single seat needs to be completely proportional to every single vote. And I think that sometimes having a little bit of geographic representativity is not that bad in an electoral system. That being said, it doesn't feel right, I think, to most people who quite like democracy, like myself, that this has been the result. But of course, it's not really in the interest of the party that just won a huge majority with 34% of the vote to then go ahead and reform the electoral system so that they could never win a majority like this ever again. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this debate? Do you have any?
Certainly not any unique or original thoughts. However, I would say, yeah, it's a pretty remarkable election, and you only need to look at Twitter at some of the more interesting accounts, because there's a lot of very boring accounts, as we know. Then you'll see some really quite remarkable facts. One of which being, you know, Clement Attlee in 1951, the 1951 election, scored a huge number more votes than Churchill, and still Churchill won the election. The same thing happened to Major in 1997. He actually won more votes than Blair. If we're going to call it, you know, Major winning the votes rather than the Conservative Party. I'm not really sure what to say about the electoral reform business, because the advantages, you know, if you hear a lot more about the disadvantages of it than you do of the actual advantages of it, right? The disadvantages of it is that you get all these votes which don't count, except maybe they do, because Starmer now, with his massive majority, will know that his majority is not built on a bedrock of stone. Rather, it's more sort of scalier than that. It's somewhat sandier, and so he'll know that he's ultimately, you know, if he wants to win the next election, and I'm sure he does, if we remove all the extraneous factors to him, then he's got to make sure that he keeps the rest of the electorate on side, no matter how large his majority is. By-elections can be won and lost, as God knows the past however many years has shown. In terms of reform, look, I'm not really sure. I don't really have a strong view about it, except one of the other advantages I'll say about this is that you will get a strong majority in Parliament. And this is what, you know, this is a great advantage of the first past the post system, is that you don't have a situation like that you might find, in certain European parliaments like the French one, is that you'll get the instability of more coalitions. We've been there before. And, you know, it allows parties to both be too big to fail and also big enough to fail, if that makes sense. And it means that all these little parties will thrive and will also struggle. So I don't know. It's very long-winded, not very erudite answer there. But I mean, I'm afraid I don't have many thoughts. However, there was another remarkable statistic, which Herman, you made me think of, which I had to try and get in, was that there are more, there are currently in Parliament, there are more cabinet members from Gordon Brown's final cabinet from 2010 than there are from Boris Johnson's 2022 after his resignation.
That's
quite a remarkable reflection of, you know, it's a remarkable reflection and illustration of what's just happened, I think. And I think that perhaps sort of puts it into some sort of perspective.
And so, I think what that statistic particularly shows is a Tory problem. Because if you can be the party that can maintain at least some of your big beasts from Tony Blair to Gordon Brown to Ed Miliband to Jeremy Corbyn to Keir Starmer, it says something about a consistency of personnel and belief within the party. If you can't maintain the sort of ideological coherence from Cameron through to Sunak, and even Boris Johnson, literally 5 years ago, his cabinet or his prime ministerial term starting, there is a question about if hardly the people in cabinet could stick around for the party and believe in what the party is about as an electoral vehicle, it's no wonder that the electorate can't be bothered to stick around either.
So, Herman, there's this sort of disease that seems to be very common in modern politics, which is that someone wins an election relatively convincingly, right? I'm thinking sort of Trump in 2016. I'm thinking Labour in the sort of 2000s. I'm thinking Boris Johnson in 2019. You can find examples around the world. And the side that's won says, you see, Barack Obama, another great example. You see, this election was paradigm shifting. This election is going to change the politics of our country. The other side often gets very depressed. In fact, they seem to buy into their own version of the same story, like, oh, we'll never win again. This is the end of our days. And I think there was a bit of a feeling of that after 2019, where I think there were some people in the Conservative Party thought, you see, we're breaking Labour in the North now for the first time ever. They've destroyed themselves under Corbyn. It'll be a 1,000-year Tory party rule of Great Britain now. And of course, it wasn't, not even close. So where do you think that sort of hubris comes from? Is it just because too often politicians are buying their own BS?
Yes, and I think it's probably that they are bad historians. It sort of makes me think about, there's this comedic character by the comedian Diane Morgan called Philomena Kunk, who is this parody of the British documentary interviewer. And people should please go watch her stuff. It is wonderful and self-defeating and self-effacing and just
I will warn anyone who wants to watch it, it will make you feel secondhand embarrassment, because the whole shtick is that she pretends to be this documentary interviewer, but then she asks very stupid questions and you just see intelligent people.
Yes.
Feeling uncomfortable.
And it is spectacular, but at one point she asked Robert Peston, who is one of those, you know, legend political journalists in the UK, so what's the most political thing that's ever happened in British history? And he just sort of ums and ahs, and she sort of looks bored, and he says it's very difficult to say. And after sort of meandering for a few seconds, he just said it's very difficult to say. You can't identify the most political. And her response was, second most political thing then. So it's sort of the what that reminds me of is sort of this idea of that something can be encapsulated as supremely paradigmatic in how it shifts things, because elections always are a response to the previous election, and the next election will be a response to this election. And if there's one thing to acknowledge, it is that,
and just on that as well, every single election anywhere in the world always produces at least one surprise somewhere. And I'm thinking just of this British election that's just happened. The Conservatives won a single seat. They lost everywhere else except one seat in Leicestershire. So now this is a little bit like saying, what lessons can we learn from this? And who knows? Maybe the lessons are that they got lucky, or that like people thought that the Labour candidate was an idiot or something like that. So you can, it's very easy to draw out narratives from these things, which are far less, far more satisfying than they have any right to be.
I
mean, I just wanted to add to that is that you know, one of the things that you may, one of the other advantages that I should have perhaps mentioned about the first past the post system, you know, which, as I said, is a rarity. It's a rare thing to talk about the advantages of such a system, which seems to waste so many votes. However, as you know, it's a moot point whether they're wasted or not. But you'll get MPs who campaign on the local ticket, as it were. And the Lib Dems, I think, very much went for that. That was their whole shtick, was going to be, you know, we're not going to do any big sweeping party political movements. Now's not the time for that. Now's the time to win on local places. Labour didn't win a single seat in a constituency where the Lib Dems were the main sparring partners of the Conservatives, and obviously had dominated the Conservatives for however many parliaments. They were all won by the Lib Dems, not a single Labour gain in that constituency. And also you'll find things like, you know, Gaza has also played the situation there has played a massive role in how Muslim voters have responded to, you know, the Conservative Party, and particularly the Labour Party, it has to be said, and their response to it. And so I you know, the local ticket is just definitely one to think about. I mean, you know, people would be baffled to hear that Corbyn won his seat. Well, I believe that Jeremy Corbyn is in fact actually a very deft and very good local MP.
Yeah.
And he'll
I think that's one of the sort of invisible advantages of the first past the post system, and especially how it manifests in the UK. It forces all politics to be local in a way, which I think, as an advocate for, you know, federalism and decentralization, I think is a useful political tool. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all of a democratic system. One should be very, very aware that every single voting system has its pros and its cons. You will always have...
I mean, South Africa, we have the complete opposite, right? Where we have no constituencies whatsoever, and we have this super proportional system, and as a result, you get sort of tiny parties who no one has ever heard of before that have like enormous power, sometimes as tiebreakers or kingmakers. You have party bosses ruling the case. You have the fact that no one knows who the MPs are because no one knows who their MP is. So there is, I think, definitely, this is, I think, exactly why a mixed system like South Africa has it as a municipal level is the way to go, because you can kind of try and balance out the positives and the negatives from both.
And what I think the Liberal Democrats did very effectively here, as it says, is to be the party of strong local candidates. And that is something that the Tories sort of learned of the hard way in 2017 with Theresa May, because the Tories were so far ahead in the polls that voters thought, okay, yeah, the Tories are going to win the national government, and I want them to win. I don't want Corbyn to be in there. He's a sort of terrorist sympathizer, lunatic lefty. I'd rather have Theresa May, who, you know, makes Marmite look exciting. But given that, I do like my local Lib Dem, or I do like my local Labour candidate. People are who sort of came back. I think if you think about a very good example of this is Vince Cable, who was defeated in 2015 by the Tory decapitation strategy under Cameron, and then came back in 2017 because he was just seen as a sort of quite a credible local MP. And what the Tories sort of did wrong is they couldn't manage the local level politics to compete with the Lib Dems, nor could they manage the national level politics to compete with Labour. And Labour could at least build something of a bridge in terms of a Labour government at national level will mean this for the constituencies that people are voting in under a Labour vision. And the Lib Dems could at least say, you know, we'll be the voice for moderate, you know, moderate, sensible politics in Parliament. The Tories, really, if they're going to rebuild, they have to rebuild at both levels. They'll have to rebuild at the level of our parliamentarians are good local representatives. And they'll have to come up with a party-wide vision that people will go, ah, so this is you know, the Tory vision. I can see hope, and I can see that speaks to me in a way. So the first past the post system allows local politics and national politics to play a big role. And incumbency is quite often a massive victim of this, as we saw with the Scottish National Party, who's been incumbent in Scotland in the devolved government for what now, 15 years or more, and the Tories after 14 years. So if looking forward, the Tories should be grateful that they are still in triple digits in terms of the seat numbers. There were some very late massive polls that put them as low as, you know, the high 50s with the you know, in a tight fight for second place between them and the Lib Dems. So they could be grateful that it isn't a wipeout, you know, of sub 100 seats. You can rebuild from roughly 120. I think Lord Hague said the other day it's possible to just be an effective opposition party with 120 seats, because you have to shadow the government. For every government position that you have, the so-called payroll vote in Parliament, that has to be shadowed by the opposition, and 120 is just enough to have a shadow across from the government in the House itself. So they are saved that embarrassment of not being able to even be a unified opposition. But now the question is what comes next? And for that, I think people should look at Kemi Badenoch's maiden speech in the Commons in, I think, 2017, which I think is good classic liberal stuff, stuff that will help the Tories move on from the soap opera and circus that they've been for the last 5 years. And a small party of 120 MPs is much easier to manage than a massive party of 400+. So Starmer and Labour, they might have a honeymoon period, and I think they will have actually quite a good first year in office. Inflation seems to be going the right direction. Immigration numbers were of great concern to many voters in the UK, going the right direction with, I think, the Office of Budget Responsibility or one of the, you know, offices saying it'll reach a 5-year low in September. The economy is picking back up again. Real wages will start creeping up again. So Starmer will have a good first year in office. Where his challenge will come is, can he satisfy the coalition he has put together in Parliament? Because you've got people who are very pro-Israel, you've got people who are very anti-Israel, you've got people who are on the social democratic center-left, then you've still got the remaining socialists who've always been there, the sort of remaining Benites, then you've got a resurgence in a sort of Blairite center-right laborism. So the real question now will be into how many factions will the Labour Party split, what will cause them to split, and how will Keir Starmer handle those splits. It sort of reminds me of the ANC, when in the ANC in South Africa, the election to elect the leader of the ANC is always treated as the election of who will lead the country, because in a way it de facto is. For now, the politics of Britain is demarcated by the 400 seats that Labour has in the House of Commons, and it's what happens between them and Downing Street that'll really be the source of tension, rather than, you know, an opposition that has less than 20% of the seats.
Exactly. I think in a certain sense, Labour will find what all political parties eventually find, which is that power is very much a bittersweet pill. It's great, but it also sucks. And it's really important to...
And it starts eroding It starts eroding the moment you have it. But Starmer has impressed me so far. I would never have voted for Keir Starmer. I like very little about him. But the way he has managed his transition into government, I think, has been, you know, stellar. I think many, many governments could learn from the way he has appointed his cabinet and read the public mood.
Yeah, he's been very skillful. Sorry, go ahead, Ed.
No, I just wanted to add to that, I think the genius of Starmer has been to make his lack of charisma actually come across as really quite charismatic, and that's sort of reflective of the absolute absolute bun fight that's going across on the conservative benches, and as you say, there are hopes. I mean, everyone will harbour individual hopes about how the Conservative Party will now rebuild itself. I know I harbour my individual hopes, and other people harbour their own individual hopes. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch, how they reconstruct themselves. But I think that's essentially what they need to do, especially given that, partially because of the nature of what's happened over the past, administrations of Boris Johnson and so on. Some of the more centrist elements of the Conservative Party have been absolutely obliterated. Many of them lost their seats in this election thanks to their association with the party. It's going to be interesting and hopefully quite a constructive period for the body politic entire, if I can put it in that rather pompous terminology.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with the very much that it's very important that you have something constructive here, because as far as I'm concerned, no political system works well unless you have at least two major political parties that are functioning and live in the real world. If you only have one, eventually it's going to go mad and start believing in nonsense.
That's where you very get important. Corbyn and Johnson. Corbyn made Johnson possible. Johnson would never have been possible without, as you say, the Labour Party losing touch with reality there.
Exactly. So I hope that the Tories do build themselves into something that is credible once again, because it'll also make Labour better. It's always good to have a good opposition. Let's just go a little bit off a side road here, up north to Scotland. With the Scottish National Party has been devastated, at least in this election. Now, they still control the government of Scotland, but after seeing these results, one has to wonder whether that's going to continue to go ahead. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I'm not a very big fan of Scottish independence, and I kind of see it as like a zombie. And while I think that like a lot of undead, the idea can never really be killed, perhaps you can put a big enough crypt stone on top of the zombie's grave to keep it in there at least for the foreseeable future. Ed, do you think Scotland has done that now? Do you think that they're going to, continue to push for another referendum on Scottish independence or anything with any real success? I mean, obviously the Scottish National Party is still going to push for that, but
yeah,
are they going to have any chance of doing it?
I fear very much, Nicholas, that crypt stones atop the zombie are not enough. It has to be, it has to be stronger than that, and it has to be more motivational than that, and it has to be better than that. However, once that dog urinates on a lamppost, that lamppost is going to be urinated on by a lot of dogs for time eternal. So not my, But no, I don't think the vote in Scotland is reflective of perhaps a lack of appetite for independence. I think that exists still. However, I think what's definitely sure is that the sort of the precipice of independence teeters on the swing voters of those for and against, those who get to the ballot box. And are presented with a referendum with the opportunity to create a new nation. That's quite a compelling argument, are you going to say yes to creating a new nation, or are you going to say no? And I think that that's where independence lives, so to speak. That's the gear it stays in. I think at the moment, perhaps, yeah, we might see a slight, hopefully, with the general improvement that hopefully the Westminster elections will bring about in the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Lib Dems, even the SNP, we'll see a... what do I mean? We'll see a general decrease in appetite for that sort of rather radical solution. However, you know, it definitely exists, but I think the SNP losses are not a reflection of the lack of a complete absence of appetite for independence. It's more of a reflection, I think, of the complete catastrophe that the SNP are actually in Scotland, that they've handled it badly. You know, they may say it's just a vote against the Tories, it's just a vote against the government. Well, the SNP are the government. And for them, you know, they're saying that independence is going to be our major priority simply isn't enough for people. And I think it, you know, it shows that actually that potential for a bright future simply won't wash. You know, you can't pull the wool over people's eyes about it and hope to encourage them that way. So yeah, independence not looking good at the moment. And you know, I don't think it's looking particularly healthy prospect in general. However, it's definitely there. As you say, you can put a cryptzone over a zombie, but a zombie, as Michael Jackson will tell us, can still rise from the dead. And so yes. that's what we're looking at, I think.
Maybe we need to take a leaf out of the book of the ancient traditions of Eastern Europe, where they would stake the corpse to the coffin to prevent it from rising again. But yes, that's not the one there. So, Herman, let's talk a little bit now. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I you were talking about a corpse and stuff. I'm like, leave Michael Heseltine out of this, man.
You see, I don't even get that joke. This is how deep your knowledge is.
very niche.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the other political party and how it might play into the Tories rebuilding themselves, and that, of course, is Reform. So there has been already, you know, I read that finest of news sources, the Daily Mail, almost daily, and I will say. You learn so many things about celebrities you didn't even know you wanted to know. There's already sort of pieces there saying, opinion pieces there saying, you know, the only way for the Tories to rebuild themselves is to take Nigel Farage into the fold and, I don't know, do some sort of deal with him. Now, this is a question, you know, the sort of the more right parts, the more sort of right-wingy populist parts of the Conservatives are saying, the only way to get those Reform voters back, who, if you add them to the Conservative voters, outnumber the Labourites, at least in this election, is to bring Nigel Farage into the fold, go right, and focus entirely on immigration. And then there's the sort of more centre ones who say, no, this is a terrible idea. We can't make any sort of deal with Reform. They don't believe the same things we do. Now, I, for one, think that any sort of deal with Farage doesn't really work unless... I don't think Nigel Farage would accept any deal that doesn't have him eventually becoming the leader of the Conservative Party. So I don't think a deal where he's, I don't know, second in command or whatever will be particularly feasible. But regardless, Herman, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that there's any chance that Reform could sort of take over the Conservatives from within?
It depends on what you mean with take over. Farage... through his initial political vehicle of UKIP, scared David Cameron enough to appease his a large part of the Tory base with the Brexit referendum, and Farage didn't even need to
vote in 2015.
Yeah, in the EU parliamentary election pre 2015, but the pressure from UKIP was significant enough for Cameron to decide, all right, you know, let's lance this boil. And that didn't work out for him. But the problem with Reform and the problem with any new party in the real world of UK politics, is that they have, by being dominated by Nigel Farage and his personal political support being such a massive part of their political capital, it overshadows the scrutiny that should by rights apply to the whole party, to all its members, to all its candidates and now MPs, and to its policies. And I think Farage will fall down once that happens. Well, not him personally, but reform. It's I think the Tories are likely to, by merely stabilizing the ship, figuring out what small C conservative is conservatism means, and you know what is the party stance on immigration, what is the party stance on free trade, what is the party stance on the vulnerability of global supply chains, the welfare state. You know, all of these things are, I think, there's enough of a conservative consensus somewhere in the institutional memory of the Conservative Party to bring back the bulk of Tory voters that might have gone to reform. Because at the end of the day, reform hasn't had the scrutiny I think it would need. And that has, I mean, the here and there where there have been scrutiny, it has shown something quite questionable. I mean, Kemi Badenoch won her constituency largely because the reform candidate was discredited because he endorsed the BNP 10 years ago. Now, the BNP, for South Africans listening, is sort of the English version of the RVA-BIA. It's quite an unpalatable bunch of people who are quite racist-y and on the far right. So reform could have, with any competent candidate, could have knocked Badenoch out of the Commons. She only won by, I think, 2,000 votes or so. And the future of the Tory party would have been, to my mind, largely decapitated. So the problem with reform is that they just have so many unknown quantities. And Farage the other day saying NATO provoked the Ukrainian war, I just don't think you'll find the small C conservative middle really open to that sort of thing. If there's something that the British have always, at least to an outsider, seem to get right, is just sort of don't be ridiculous, you know, don't be out there, don't be too provocative. There is something quite moderate, I think, intrinsic in the British psyche, to what I can see at least, and reform doesn't really fit to that. So I think by merely showing that they can be a unified party, reform, the Tories can remove the reform threat, I think, largely.
I just want to add to that. That sort of catalogue of, by the way, I've just remembered the word I was thinking of earlier about the SNP, not to be complacent. That's what I meant to say. That's a more succinct version of what, you know, when you think of something after that, you leave the party and you think, oh, I should have said that. But anyway, I think what you've said, what you've outlined there, Herman, in terms of the catalogue of things that you listed about Nigel Farage and all the rest of it and reform, is you're showing how you can't beat Nigel Farage at being Nigel Farage. You can't, and that's the attraction of Nigel Farage, I think, is partially that he is this sort of, you know, slightly bizarre, driving to the electoral, driving to cast his vote in a Land Rover. All the rest of it, and a military Land Rover. I mean, not just a normal, instead of standing at the top, a military Land Rover and all the rest of it. You can't out Farage Nigel Farage, and I think that's the salient point about reform, and they may be splitting the conservative votes, they may be inside the sort of conservative citadel. However, I think one of the major proofs that if anything the conservatives have failed over the past few parliaments. You know, even if they've tried to be a bit more, reform Farageist, shall we say, in terms of being anti-migrant, stop the boat, you know, a bit more controlled about migration and all the rest of it. The reform candidates are still trespassing on conservative voters, no matter how in that direction the Conservative Party seems to be progressing. Am I making myself quite clear? And therefore, it just shows you that the two don't work together. And so the Conservatives need to take that into account when they're doing their great rethink, I think.
But I do think that one of the problems is that immigration is a Blairite hangover in the sense that it really turbocharged during his premiership, and it sort of highlights a fault line in the traditional centre-right coalition of voters. Is you've got your small-c social conservatives that want to maintain, you know, the things of sovereignty and nationhood and communities and traditions. And it brings a clash in the sense that migration on the whole in the UK has been economically advantageous. Now, I say economically advantageous, not necessarily for the individual people who might feel excluded from the global economy because they are in you know, a forgotten part of Wales or England. But economically, migrants to England, on the whole, have been beneficial. So it's for those who are market-led conservatives in the you know, GDP must go up sense, migration has been a boon to the British economy. But for those who are conservatives in the sense that, you know, what does it mean to be English? How can that be preserved? Immigration is something of an existential threat, whether real or imagined. I think, you know, in some of the parts that have the lowest number of migrants, Reform and UKIP have traditionally done best. So there's something quite counterintuitive about that. And someone like the person who will be the next leader of the Conservative Party must find a way to marry those two sentiments, to not dismiss concerns about immigration and you know, social conservatism, and to make that work with the idea of being a free trade, free market entity. So the Farage problem for the Tories will come in the sense that they don't need to out-Farage him. They need to remove the issue, or they need to remove the salience and the momentum of the immigration issue that has been such a driver for social conservatives and become, you know, one of the hallmarks of why has housing failed? Well, immigration. Why is the NHS under strain? Well, immigration. Why are wages being pushed down? Well, immigration. If you don't have good answers from the Conservative Party on fixing housing, fixing the NHS, and what will get wages rising again, Farage will continually be able to point at this immigration issue, and that will be a sufficient explanation for him to maintain political momentum. So it's not perhaps about out-Faraging Farage. It is by finding out where Farage gets his air from so that you can turn off that valve. And I think that is the problem with immigration, is it means so many things to so many people that when Farage says he will fix it, he's actually not saying he will fix one policy area. He's actually saying he will fix five or six.
I think that's a good point about how it is. It's a sort of stand-in for so many people of so many issues with how they don't like what government is doing. All right, let's kind of wrap it up soonish. Very briefly, Herman, who are the major contenders for the Tory leadership now?
I would say three names would be Kemi Badenoch, Robin Jenrick, and Tom Tugendhat, who will be, I think, the most likely successors. Then you also have Suella Braverman and Priti Patel, who I think are, you know, they've missed their opportunity to lead the party. So, yeah. Those are the three names I'd watch out for. Possibly Victoria Atkins as well. But those are the three people I think will be the main forces in the leadership election.
And I think the last one, so we had a sort of little chat online about what questions we were going to ask in home. And one of the ones you suggested we discuss is, are we looking at a decade of Labour in power? And I think we've kind of dealt with that already. But to ask, answer the question, I mean, there are going to be at least a couple of probably Labour-leaning people who will say something along the lines of, you see, we've triumphed, we've done everything right now, and yes, our vote share will go up next election. We're all good and happy. We're going to be in power forever because this was a change election. And we've fairly, I think, decisively bashed out that idea that elections are truly decisive because they almost never are. But what do you think of Labour's prospects for the next 5 years?
Well, I think the next 2 years will be positive for them. I think they've got 2 years to have some good momentum on living standards, on a reset with a relationship with the European Union. Donald Trump's possible victory in November is going to be, I think, a significant challenge to their Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who is properly on the left. And I don't really see how he will establish the common ground with Trump presidency. But at some point, the Labour will start bashing their heads into many of the same issues that the Tories have been unable to solve over the last 14 years. The slow pace of housing, the idea of property ownership becoming less and less of a reality for new generations, with Operation Rent really being dependent on the affordability of that sort of accommodation. And immigration is going to be something that Labour will have to deal with. The Tories haven't been able to do that. I mean, they had the promise ever since 2010 to bring it into the tens of thousands, i.e. under 100,000, and they really didn't manage that. And they tried various things. And Labour will at some stage need to confront that as well. Otherwise, they will probably just, have the same cynical response from especially your red wall voters who feel that immigration is a threat to their standing within the economy, whatever it might do to GDP figures and the ability of businesses to have labour supplies at relatively cheap cost.
Ed, any final thoughts before we close for today?
No, I think Herman's has summarized it perfectly. I'd say that certainly Suella looks like she's completely out of the water, Labour today, or Rachel Reeves, has certainly already started taking the battering ram to some of those issues that you were just discussing there. So planning being the major one, and looking about how to get the sort of planning reforms through in order to try and work towards that keyword growth, which has been the sort of completely been the watchword of the Labour Party throughout the campaign. And I think foreign policy is also going to be interesting. And I think it's important to note that in thinking about Ukraine, Labour has promised to maintain the conservative increase in defence spending to 2.5% to provide enough aid to Ukraine for missiles and so forth. However, they have failed to commit to the deadline which the Conservatives had of getting that done by 2030. They want to do it as soon as possible, quote unquote, which could, as you can probably tell, that can be an awfully long time. I think it's worth watching. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's very easy for as soon as possible to be never. That'll be interesting to see. Anyway, we will be back, of course, to discussing South Africa tomorrow. We just thought that with all the focus on the government of national unity and a little bit of slowdown in South African news, it might be good to have a look at overseas, see what's going on in one of the world's most important countries. Unfortunately, I think we don't have quite the same insights into France, but from what I've read about the French election, the level of skullduggery and personal shenanigans that has been going on behind the scenes in that election is truly spectacular. Betrayals, counter-betrayals, it's incredible in a way that only the French political system could be. But yeah, we'll maybe discuss some of that, I think, tomorrow. Anyway, I hope that you found this show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily French Show Wrap. Cheers, everyone.